Welcome to Trinity Rep Radio Theater, a production of Trinity Repertory Company and WRNI. Trinity Rep Radio Theater is a monthly exploration of dramatic literature featuring members of Trinity Rep's resident acting company. Today's program is titled Spoils of War. I'm your host, Bob C., and joining me is Kurt Columbus, Trinity Rep's artistic director.
Hello, Bob.
And three members of Trinity's resident acting company, Stephen Berenson, Janice Duclos, and Stephen Thorne. Welcome, everyone.
Hello, thanks, Bob.
Thanks for having us.
Kurt, tell us about today's program.
Well, Bob, Trinity Rep's new play is called The Dreams of Antigone, and it was inspired by Sophocles' Antigone. It's about doing the right thing after a great conflict, and so we've been thinking about war and the spoils of war, what happens after a war in a country. So the theme was a natural choice, and we've chosen three pieces. Kurt Vonnegut's short story called Report on the Barnhouse Effect. There's also Lafayette, Farewell by Ray Bradbury, and a poem called My War by Diane C. Yeager. So I think we'll start with Lafayette, Farewell by Ray Bradbury. And Bob, it's important to point out, Bradbury is best known as an author of science fiction, fantasy, things like that. But he's really a prolific writer who has a wide range of stories. And this one's actually was published originally in 1988, and it has a lot to do with our theme today.
Well, let's hear Lafayette Farewell by Ray Bradbury with Stephen Berenson and Stephen Thorne here on Trinity Rep Radio Theater.
There was a tap on the door. The bell was not rung, so I knew who it was. The tapping used to happen once a week, but in the past few weeks it came every other day. I shut my eyes, said a prayer, and opened the door. Bill Westerly was there, looking at me, tears streaming down his cheeks.
Is this my house or yours?
It was an old joke now. Several times a year he wandered off, an 89-year-old man, to get lost within a few blocks. He had quit driving years ago. His best journey nowadays was from next door, where he lived with his wondrously warm and understanding wife, to here, where he tapped, entered, and wept. Sometimes he reversed the usual order.
Is this your house or mine?
Mi casa es su casa, and thank God for that! I led the way to the parlor and poured two glasses of sherry, while Bill settled in an easy chair across from me. He wiped his eyes and blew his nose on a handkerchief, which he then folded neatly and put back in his breast pocket.
Here's to you, Buster. The sky is full of 'em. I hope you come back. If not, we'll drop a black wreath where we think your crate fell.
The escadrille been buzzing you again?
Every night. Right after midnight. Every morning now. And the last week, noons. I try not to come over. I tried for 3 days.
I know. I missed you.
I know I'm a pest when I have my clear moments.
You want to talk about it?
You sound just like a psychiatrist friend of mine. Not that I ever went to one. He was just a friend. Great thing about coming over here is it's free and sherry to boot. It's a terrible thing to be haunted by ghosts.
We all have them. That's where Shakespeare was so bright. He taught himself, taught us, taught psychiatrists. Don't do bad, he said, or your ghosts will get you. The old remembrance, the conscience which doth make cowards and scare midnight men, will rise up and cry, Hamlet, remember me. Macbeth, you're marked. Lady Macbeth, you too. Richard III, beware. We walk the dawn camp at your shoulder, and our shrouds are stiff with blood.
God, you talk pretty. Nice living next door to a writer. When I need a dose of poetry, here you are.
I tend to lecture. It bores my friends.
Well, not me, dear Buster, not me. But you're right. I mean, what we were talking about. Ghosts. I fly all the time now. It's 1918 more than it's 1987. It's France more than it's the U.S. of A. I'm up there with the old Lafayette. I'm on the ground near Paris with Rickenbacker. And there, just as the sun goes down, is the Red Baron. I've had quite a life, haven't I, Sam?
It was his affectionate mode to call me by 6 or 7 assorted names. I loved them all.
Did I ever show you the picture of myself and the whole Lafayette Escadrille team lined up by our junky biplane in the summer of 18?
He pulled a small photo from his wallet and tossed it across to me. I had seen it 100 times, but it was a wonder and a delight.
That's me in the middle left, the short guy with the dumb smile, next to Rickenbacker.
I looked at all the dead men, for most were long dead now. And there was Bill, 20 years old and lark happy. And all the other young, oh dear God, young men lined up, arms around each other. And behind them a French 7-1 biplane. And beyond, the flat airfield somewhere near the Western Front. Sounds of flying came out of the damn picture. They always did when I held it. And sounds of wind and birds. It was like a miniature TV screen. At any moment, I expected the Lafayette Escadrille to burst into action, spin, run, and take off into that absolutely clear and endless sky.
God, I love showing you things. You're so damned appreciative. I wish I'd had you around when I was making films at MGM.
That was the other part of Bill Westerly. From fighting and photographing the Western Front half a mile up, he had moved on when he got back to the States. From the Eastman Labs in New York, he had drifted to Hollywood to film Gloria Swanson. From MGM, he had shipped to Africa to shoot lions and the Watusi for King Solomon's Mines. Around the world studios, there was no one he didn't know or who didn't know him. He had been principal cameraman on some 200 films, and there were 2 bright gold Academy Oscars on his mantle next door. I'm sorry I grew up so long after you. Where's that photo of you and Rickenbacker alone? And the one signed by von Richthofen?
Oh, you don't want to see them, Buster.
Like hell I don't. He unfolded his wallet and gently held out the picture of himself and Captain Eddie, and the single snap of von Richthofen, signed in ink below.
All gone, most of them. Just 1 or 2 now and me left. And it won't be long before there's not even me. The thing is, I'm not afraid of dying. I'm just afraid of dying and going to hell.
You're not going there, Bill.
Yes, I am. For what I did, what I can never be forgiven for.
What was that, Bill?
All those young boys I killed. All those young men I destroyed. All those beautiful people I murdered.
You never did that, Bill.
Yes, I did. In the sky, damn it, in the air over France, over Germany so long ago. But Jesus, there they are, every night now. Alive again, flying, waving, yelling, laughing like boys. Until I fire my guns between the propellers and their wings catch fire and spin down. Sometimes they wave to me, okay, as they fall. Sometimes they curse, but Jesus, every night, every morning now, the last month, they never leave. Oh, those beautiful boys, those lovely young men, those fine faces, the great, shining, and loving eyes, and down they go. And I did it, and I'll burn in hell for it.
You will not, I repeat, not burn in hell.
Give me another drink and shut up. What do you know about who burns and who doesn't? Are you Catholic? No. Are you Baptist? Baptists burn more slowly.
William, no one burns in hell for war. War's that way.
We'll all burn.
Bill, at this very moment in Germany, there's a man your age, bothered with the same dreams, crying in his beer, remembering too much.
He'll burn, too, remembering my friends, the lovely boys who got themselves screwed into the ground when their propellers chewed the way. Don't you see? They didn't know. I didn't know. No one told them. No one told us.
What?
What war was. Christ, we didn't know it would come after us, find us so late in time. We thought it was all over, that we had a way to forget, put it off, bury it. No one guessed that one day, in old age, The graves would bust wide, and all those lovely faces come up, and the whole war with them. How could we guess that? But now the time's here, and the skies are full. It's so terrible. It's so sad. How do I save them? What do I do to go back and say, Christ, I'm sorry. It should never have happened. Someone should have warned us when we were happy. War's not just dying, it's remembering, and remembering late as well as soon. I wish them well. How do I say that? What's the next move?
There is no move. Just sit here with a friend and have another drink. I can't think of anything to do. I wish I could.
Let me tell you, then. Tonight, maybe tomorrow night, the last time you'll ever see me. Okay. Hear me out. They've been landing in our backyards the last few nights. You wouldn't have heard parachutes make sounds like kites, soft kind of whispers. The parachutes come down on our back lawns. Other nights, the bodies without parachutes. The good nights are the quiet ones when you just hear the silk and the threads on the clouds. The bad ones are when you hear 180 pounds of aviator hit the grass. Then you can't sleep. Last night, a dozen things hit the bushes near my bedroom window. I looked up in the clouds tonight, and they were full of planes and smoke. Do you believe me?
That's the one thing. I do believe.
Thank God. But what do I do next?
Have you tried talking to them? I mean, have you asked for their forgiveness?
Would they listen? Would they forgive? My God, of course. Why not? Will you come with me? Your backyard. No trees for them to get strung up in. No, on your porch.
I opened the living room French doors and stepped out. It was a calm evening with only touches of wind motioning the trees and changing the clouds. Bill was behind me, a bit unsteady on his feet, a hopeful grin, part panic, on his face. I looked at the sky and the rising moon. Nothing out here.
Oh, yes, there is. Look, no, wait. Listen. Do we stand out in the middle of your garden where they can see us?
A toast to the Lafayette Escadrille.
No. They mustn't hear that. To them, Doug, to von Richthofen, and the beautiful, sad young men.
To the beautiful, sad young men. And we lifted our empty glasses so the clouds and the moon and the silent sky could see.
I'm ready if they want to come get me now. What'll I say to them?
God, Bill, I don't know. They're not my friends.
They weren't mine either. More's the pity. I thought they were the enemy. Christ, isn't that a dumb, stupid, half-assed word, the enemy? As if such a thing ever really happened in the world. Sure, maybe the bully that chased and beat you up in the schoolyard, or the guy who took your girl and laughed at you, but them, those beauties up in the clouds on summer days or autumn afternoons, no, no. All right, here I am.
He moved farther out on the porch, leaned way out, and opened his arms as if to embrace the night air.
Come on! What are you waiting for?
And he tilted his head back as if to welcome a dark rain. He stared upward, willing the clouds to shift and change and become something more than clouds.
I killed you all. Forgive me, or come kill me. Forgive me. I'm sorry.
The force of his voice was enough to push me completely back into shadows. Maybe that did it. Maybe Bill, standing like a small statue in the middle of my garden, made the clouds shift and the wind blow south instead of north. We both heard, a long way off, an immense whisper.
There.
Another sound, closer now, like blossoms lifted off spring trees and run along the sky. The clouds seemed to form a lid, and make a vast silken shape which dropped in serene silence upon the land. It made a shadow that crossed the town, and hid the houses, and at last reached our garden. and shadowed the grass, and put out the light of the moon, and then hid Bill from my sight.
Yes, they're coming. Feel them? One, two, a dozen.
And all around in the dark, I thought I heard apples and plums and peaches falling from unseen trees, the sound of boots hitting my lawn, and the sound of pillows striking the grass like bodies, and the swarming of white silk or smoke flung across the disturbed air.
They're all around. Get back. Yes.
There was a tumult in the garden. The hedges shivered with propeller wind. A tin watering can blew across the yard. Birds were flung from trees. Dogs all around the block yelped. A siren from another war sounded 10 miles away. A storm had arrived, and was that thunder or field artillery?
I didn't know. Oh, God, I didn't know what I was doing. Please.
And the rain fell briefly to mix with the tears on his face. And the rain stopped, and the wind was still.
Well, time to go. Do you think I'll get lost again?
If you do, come here.
Sure. How much do I owe you, Sigmund?
Only this. I gave him a hug. He walked out to the street. I followed to watch. When he got to the corner, he turned to his right, then his left. I waited. To your left, Bill.
God bless you, Buster.
He waved, turned, and went into his house. They found him a month later, wandering 2 miles from home. A month after that, he was in the hospital. In France, all the time now. And Rickenbacker in the bed to his right, and von Richthofen in the cot to his left. The day after his funeral, his Oscar arrived, carried by his wife, to place on my mantle with a single red rose beside it, and the picture of von Richthofen and the other picture of the gang lined up in the summer of 18, and the wind blowing out of the picture, and the buzz of planes, and the sound of young men laughing as if they might go on forever. Sometimes I come down at 3 in the morning when I can't sleep, and I stand looking at Bill and his friends. Farewell, Lafayette. Lafayette, farewell. And they all laugh as if it were the grandest joke they ever heard.
We've just heard Ray Bradbury's Lafayette Farewell, read by Stephen Berenson and Stephen Thorne, here on Trinity Rep Radio Theater. Well, Stephen Thorne, you play an old soldier haunted by the ghosts of the past war. Tell us how you felt doing this role.
that's a great question. One of the things about this story that I find most affecting is that he is, 89 years old, and at the end of his life or nearing the end of his life, and the experience seems the most intense, which seems to almost defy logic a little bit. You'd think that something that happened in 1918 would be the most intense, but what he's claiming is that it's not only lived with him for all of his life, it's even in more intensity now at this moment, and he can't quite figure that out. And I find that heartbreaking, quite honestly.
Yeah, it's also, we've talked a lot about this in rehearsal, that the fact that Bradbury positions us as listeners in between fantasy and reality, which is right where Bill is, right?
Yeah.
I mean, his dementia sort of has him walking the line between fantasy and reality. And Bradbury and we as listeners go with him and start to wonder, is his fantasy more real than reality, I think? You know, you start to wonder, is it possible that the effect of war 80 years on is more felt or more fully felt than it was at the moment?
Well, I can address that because I have a personal anecdote, which is really personal, but it's so in keeping with this story, which is that my father was a World War II vet, and I think like most vets, he never spoke about being in the war. anything he talked about was funny. And he would tell stories about the guys and the laughter and, you know, all of his experiences. And then at the very end of his life, he became ill and he began to talk about it quite a bit. And sometimes he would call me in the middle of the day to just say, oh, I just remembered this and I wanted to share it with you. And at the very end of his life, when he was literally on his deathbed, his last words, he began to talk to his men. Wow. And his very last words were, oh, my God, they shot Grant. And he had never spoken of it. I had no idea who Grant was, but I was completely aware of who he was speaking of and what experience he was having. And, you know, I think that people, especially from that generation, from the greatest generation, put it away and came back to start over and got through their ticker tape parades and then moved on with their lives, because that was what was expected, because so many men had had that experience, but you didn't inflict it on your children.
And what's fascinating about that, Stephen, and especially in regard to our next piece, is that the veterans of World War II, veterans of World War I, got to celebrate on some level what had happened to them, to have a good time with it. And, you know, one of the main complaints about the Vietnam conflict is that those who survived it didn't ever get to have that kind of moment.
There was no ticker tape.
There was no ticker tape.
Although there were monuments to the Vietnam War, and there were no monuments to World War II, which is so interesting because the whole generation thought this is a war that no one will forget.
That's unforgettable.
And only now are we having the monuments like the one in Providence.
Yeah. Bob, if you don't mind, I think we're going to move on to our next piece just because it feels like a perfect segue. This is a poem from the anthology Visions of War, Dreams of Peace. It's Writings of Women in the Vietnam War.
And we're going to hear My War by Diane C. Jaeger, read by Janice Duclos.
Did I ever tell you how proud I was of myself for setting out to do something, for not just sitting back and watching anymore, for finding a way, with little regard for the consequences, to help out, to do my part, to stand alongside those suffering victims of war? How proud I was for making my own statement about support, love, and loyalty, even amidst the confusion about what it all meant. For having the guts to act and not just ignore it anymore. Did I ever tell you what it meant to me, the Vietnam War? Did I ever tell you how scared I was for myself, for the decision I'd made, for the position I'd taken, for the validity of my resolve, the appropriateness of my response, the effect on my family? How scared I was for my ability to be effective in the performance of my duties, for my future, my strength and stamina, and my survival, for whether the course I'd chosen was a mistake. Did I ever tell you how embarrassed and ashamed I became to think that we'd all been taken by a people who hated our presence, who took advantage of our caring, who laughed behind our backs and betrayed us in the night? By a nation back home who didn't care, who went on with life as though we didn't exist, who'd written us off, who never noticed our return. How we'd all been taken by a God who seemed to have deserted us all to suffer through, to die, to live alone with our pain forever. Did I ever tell you what it meant to me, the Vietnam War? Did I ever tell you how we grew together, my new family and I? How we stuck up for each other, laughed together to forget, lived as though it didn't matter how torn up we were becoming inside, how we knew nothing else would ever be the same again, and no one else nor nothing else would ever have the intensity of meaning again. How we longed for home, the world, and the old ways. But knew they no longer existed and hated to leave one another, although we never really said so. My new family and I, how we walked away from it all as though it never existed nor mattered, with all resolve to forget. How we never really could forget those who died, how we needed to cry but couldn't, how we never again felt home nor family in the way we did there through the struggle and pain of Vietnam. Did I ever tell you that? Did I ever tell you how hard I tried and with what pride of accomplishment I did what needed to be done when the dying was too often, the bodies too hurt to repair, the grief beyond words and feeling, when babies cried and when they died, when the smells, the sounds of suffering, and the recognition of lost limbs, function, health, and life had to be dealt with in kids younger than ourselves, 18, 19, 20, 21, and up to ages beyond the years that we'd attained. How I did what needed to be done when the meaning of it all only came out, ugh, hopeless, useless, and worthless. Ugh, a waste. Did I ever tell you what I felt? Did I ever tell you about that part of me that was buried somewhere within me for 13 years after coming back from Vietnam in 1971? Did I ever tell you about being a nurse in a war? My war.
We've been listening to the poem My War by Diane Jagger, read by Janice Duclos, here on Trinity Rep Radio Theater. Janice, that really sums up so many of the emotions and thoughts about the Vietnam War.
Oh, my gosh. You know, Diane Jagger, we know so little about her. She just seems to be one of many nurses who served in the Vietnam War and was asked to contribute to this book. And she did, and she wrote this incredible piece. And I think she sums up all the frustrations, all the joy, all the pride. It was such an interesting piece to work on. And in rehearsal, we talked about point of view. And since we knew so little about this, we talked about who is she talking to? Who is she saying this to? I mean, she could just be talking to the world at large that didn't take part in this war, and do you know what it was like? Is she talking to her family about her experience? Is she talking to her children about what happened so long ago? And it was interesting making choices about this particular piece.
I loved listening to this in rehearsal and realizing that at least one choice that I noticed Janice make was that this was the first time that there was a real newness to speaking about this that just is so incredibly powerful in listening to it. I mean, it really just the notion that it's life in a war is more intense and that home and family will never be the same for her. And she's never spoken that.
Yes, and that seems to be a theme through all the work that we looked at in trying to find material for this particular show, that the intensity of the way you live in a war zone is never matched again when you come back home. And I think that's part of what leaves people with these feelings that, you know, as in the previous story, they never go away, and they crop up at the end of your life.
Well, he also had this sense of guilt, which you don't really have. You did your duty. You did what was expected of you, and you're making an observation about the chaos and the uselessness of the war. But I don't get the same feeling of guilt that I got from
But don't you find from the poem, though, Bob, that there's a complicated response to duty mm-hmm. that she has? I mean, I really catch that in Janice's portrayal. It's she's saying those words, but those words have layers, and it's not just as simple as I did my duty. I think I'm mm-hmm. I'm catching that.
Yes, and it's different than saying I did my duty in World War II, where people seem to appreciate what you were doing. Mm-hmm. When during the Vietnam War there was such conflict about whether or not we should be there, and I think that the soldiers felt that they felt the brunt of that, because when they came back, what they did didn't seem to be appreciated in the same way.
Mm-hmm. So that we must move from the sublime to the, well, let's say to the less sublime. We wanted to include Kurt Vonnegut, the great, great American author, 20th century American author, because everything that he does, Bob, is inflected by war and his experiences, particularly in World War II. He's, of course, the author of Slaughterhouse-Five and many, many other books. This story is called Report on the Barnhouse Effect, and it was first published in 1950, and we can talk about it afterwards.
Okay. Let's hear Kurt Vonnegut's report on the Barnhouse Effect with Stephen Berenson, Kurt Columbus, and Stephen Thorne here on Trinity Rep Radio Theater.
Let me begin by saying that I don't know any more about where Professor Arthur Barnhouse is hiding than anyone else does, save for one short enigmatic message left in my mailbox on Christmas Eve. I have not heard from him since his disappearance a year and a half ago. What's more, listeners will be disappointed if they expect to learn how they can bring about the so-called Barnhouse effect. If I were able and willing to give away that secret, I would certainly be something more than a psychology instructor. I have been urged to make this report because I did research under the professor's direction, and because I was the first to learn of his astonishing discovery. But while I was his student, I was never entrusted with knowledge of how the mental forces could be released and directed. He was unwilling to trust anyone with that information. I would like to point out that the term Barnhouse effect is a creation of the popular press and was never used by Professor Barnhouse. The name he chose for the phenomenon was dynamopsychism, or force of the mind. I think humanity has always had an inkling that this sort of force does exist. It has been common knowledge that some people are luckier than others with inanimate objects like dice. What Professor Barnhouse did was to show that such luck was a measurable force, which, in his case, could be enormous. By my calculations, the professor was about 55 times more powerful than a Nagasaki-type atomic bomb at the time he went into hiding. There is an understandable tendency to look upon Professor Barnhouse as a supernatural visitation, but neither he nor his powers fall outside the sphere of nature. His dynamo psychic radiations are subject to many known physical laws that apply in the field of radio. Hardly a person has not now heard the snarl of Barnhouse static on his home receiver. However, they differ from ordinary broadcast waves in several important ways. Their total energy can be brought to bear on any single point the professor chooses, and that energy is undiminished by distance. As a weapon, then, dynamopsychism has an impressive advantage over bacteria and atomic bombs, beyond the fact that it costs nothing to use. It enables the professor to single out critical individuals and objects instead of slaughtering whole populations in the process of maintaining international equilibrium. Popularly, the age of Barnhouse is said to have begun a year and a half ago, on the day of Operation Brainstorm. That was when dynamopsychism became significant politically. Actually, the phenomenon was discovered in May 1942, shortly after the professor turned down a direct commission in the army and enlisted as an artillery private. Like X-rays and vulcanized rubber, dynamopsychism was discovered by accident. From time to time, Private Barnhouse was invited to take part in games of chance by his barrack mates. He knew nothing about the games and usually begged off, but one evening, out of social grace, he agreed to shoot craps. "Shoot sevens," they said. And he did. 10 in a row to bankrupt the barracks. He retired to his bunk and, as a mathematical exercise, calculated the odds against this feat on the back of a laundry slip. His chances of doing it, he found, were 1 in almost 10 million. Bewildered, he borrowed a pair of dice from the man in the bunk next to his. He tried to roll sevens again, but got only the usual assortment of numbers. He lay back for a moment, then resumed his toying with the dice. He rolled 10 more sevens in a row. He might have dismissed the phenomenon with a low whistle, but the professor instead mulled over the circumstances surrounding his 2 lucky streaks. There was 1 single factor in common. On both occasions, the same thought train had flashed through his mind just before he threw the dice. It was that thought train which aligned the professor's brain cells into what has since become the most powerful weapon on Earth. Professional caution kept him from revealing his discovery immediately. He wanted more facts and a body of theory to go with them. Later, when the atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, it was fear that made him hold his peace. In time, he came to recognize another startling feature of dynamo psychism. Its strength increased with use. By the time of his discharge in 1945, he could knock bricks loose from chimneys 3 miles away. He had the range and power of a 37-millimeter cannon. But his dynamo psychic powers graduated from the small arms class after his return to Wyandotte College. I enrolled in the Wyandotte Graduate School 2 years after the professor had rejoined the faculty. By chance, he was assigned as my thesis advisor. I was unhappy about the assignment, for the professor was, in the eyes of both colleagues and students, a somewhat ridiculous figure. He had missed classes or had lapses of memory during lectures. When I arrived, in fact, his shortcomings had passed from the ridiculous to the intolerable. When I reported to the professor's laboratory for the first time, what I saw was more distressing than the gossip. Every surface in the room was covered with dust. Books and apparatus had not been disturbed for months. The professor sat napping at his desk when I entered. The only signs of recent activity were 3 overflowing ashtrays, a pair of scissors, and a morning paper with several items clipped from its front page. As he raised his head to look at me, I saw that his eyes were clouded with fatigue.
"Hello. Just can't seem to get my sleeping done at night."
He lighted a cigarette, his hands trembling slightly.
"You the young man I'm supposed to help with a thesis?"
"Yes, sir." In minutes, he converted my misgivings to alarm.
"You an overseas veteran?"
"Yes, sir."
"Not much left over there, is there? Enjoy the last war?"
"No, sir."
"Look like another war to you?"
"Kind of, sir."
"What can be done about it?"
"Looks pretty hopeless."
"Know anything about international law, the UN and all that?"
"Only what I pick up from the papers."
"Same here."
He showed me a fat scrapbook packed with newspaper clippings.
"Never used to pay any attention to international politics. Now I study them the way I used to study rats in mazes. Everybody tells me the same thing. Looks hopeless."
"Nothing short of a miracle
believe could make in magic?"
The professor fished 2 dice from his vest pocket.
"I will try to roll 2s.
He rolled 2s 3 times in a row.
"One chance in about 47,000 of that happening. There's a miracle for you."
He beamed for an instant, then brought the interview to an end, remarking that he had a class which had begun 10 minutes ago. He was not quick to take me into his confidence, and he said no more about his trick with the dice. I assumed they were loaded and forgot about them. He set me the task of watching male rats cross electrified metal strips to get to food or female rats, an experiment that had been done to everyone's satisfaction in the 1930s. As though the pointlessness of my work were not bad enough, the professor annoyed me further with irrelevant questions. His favorites were...
"Think we should have dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima?"
And?
Think every new piece of scientific information is a good thing for humanity?
However, I did not feel put upon for long. One morning after I had been with him only a month, he said,
"Give those poor animals a holiday. I wish you'd help me look into a more interesting problem, namely, my sanity."
I returned the rats to their cages.
"What you must do is simple. Watch the inkwell on my desk. If you see nothing happen to it, say so. And I'll go quietly, relieved, I might add, to the nearest sanitarium."
I nodded, uncertainly. He locked the laboratory door and drew the blinds.
"I'm odd, I know. It's fear of myself that's made me odd."
"I've found you somewhat eccentric, perhaps, but
if nothing happens to that inkwell, crazy as a bedbug is the only description of me that will do. To give you an idea of how crazy, I'll tell you what's been running through my mind when I should have been sleeping. I think maybe I can save the world. I think maybe I can make every nation a have nation and do away with war for good. I think maybe I can clear roads through jungles, irrigate deserts, build dams overnight."
"Yes, sir."
"Watch the inkwell."
Dutifully and fearfully, I watched. A high-pitched humming seemed to come from the inkwell. Then it began to vibrate alarmingly, and finally, to bound about the top of the desk, making two noisy circuits. It stopped, hummed again, glowed red, then popped in splinters with a blue-green flash. Perhaps my hair stood on end. "Magnets?"
"Wish to heaven it were magnets."
It was then that he told me of dynamo psychism. He knew only that there was such a force. He could not explain it.
"It's me and me alone. And it's awful."
"I'd say it was amazing and wonderful."
"If all I could do was make inkwells dance, I'd be tickled silly with the whole business. But I'm no toy, my boy."
He told me about pulverized boulders, shattered oaks, and abandoned farm buildings demolished within a 50-mile radius of the campus.
"Did every bit of it sitting right here, just thinking. Not even thinking hard. I have never dared to concentrate as hard as I can for fear of the damage I might do. I'm to the point where a mere whim is a blockbuster. Up until a few days ago, I've thought it best to keep my secret for fear of what use it might be put to. Now I realize that I haven't any more right to it than a man has a right to own an atomic bomb."
He fumbled through a heap of papers.
"This says about all that needs to be said, I think."
He handed me a draft of a letter to the Secretary of State. "Dear sir, I have discovered a new force which costs nothing to use, and which is probably more important than atomic energy. I should like to see it used most effectively in the cause of peace, and am therefore requesting your advice as to how this might best be done. Yours truly, A. Barnhouse."
I have no idea what will happen next.
There followed 3 months of perpetual nightmare, wherein the nation's political and military great came at all hours to watch the professor's tricks. We were quartered in an old mansion near Charlottesville, Virginia, to which we had been whisked 5 days after the letter was mailed. Surrounded by barbed wire and 20 guards, we were labeled Project Wishing Well and were classified as top secret. For companionship, we had General Honus Barker and the State Department's William K. Cuthrell. For the professor's talk of peace through plenty, they had indulgent smiles and much discourse on practical measures and realistic thinking. So treated, the professor, who had at first been almost meek, progressed in a matter of weeks towards stubbornness. He had agreed to reveal the thought train, by which means he aligned his mind into a dynamo psychic transmitter. But, under their nagging to do so, he began to hedge. At first, he declared that the information could be passed on simply by word of mouth. Later, he said that it would have to be written up in a long report. Finally, at dinner one night, just after General Barker had read the secret orders for Operation Brainstorm, the professor announced,
"The report may take as long as 5 years to write."
He looked fiercely at the general.
"Maybe 20.
The dismay occasioned by this flat announcement was offset somewhat by the exciting anticipation of Operation Brainstorm. The general was in a holiday mood.
The target ships are on their way to the Caroline Islands at this very moment. 120 of them. At the same time, 10 V-2s are being readied for firing in New Mexico, and 50 radio-controlled jet bombers are being equipped for a mock attack on the Aleutians. Just think of it. At exactly 1100 hours next Wednesday, I will give you the order to concentrate. And you, Professor, will think as hard as you can about sinking the target ships, destroying the V-2s before they hit the ground, and knocking down bombers before they reach the Aleutians. Think you can handle it?
The professor turned gray and closed his eyes.
As I told you before, my friend, I don't know what I can do. As for this Operation Brainstorm, I was never consulted about it, and it strikes me as childish and insanely expensive.
Sir, your field is psychology, and I wouldn't presume to give you advice in that field. Mine is national defense. I have 30 years of experience and success, Professor, and I'll ask you not to criticize my judgment.
Look, isn't it war and military matters we're all trying to get rid of? Wouldn't it be a whole lot more significant and lots cheaper for me to try moving cloud masses into drought areas and things like that? I admit I know next to nothing about international politics, but it seems reasonable to suppose that nobody would want to fight wars if there were enough of everything to go around. Mr. Cuthrell, I'd like to try running generators where there isn't any coal or water power, irrigating deserts and so on. Why, you could figure out what each country needs to make the most of its resources, and I could give it to them without costing American taxpayers a penny.
Eternal vigilance is the price of freedom.
Mr. Cuthrell threw the general a look of mild distaste.
Unfortunately, the general is right in his own way. I wish to heaven the world were ready for ideals like yours, Professor, but it simply isn't. We aren't surrounded by brothers, but by enemies. It isn't a lack of food or resources that has us on a brink of war. It's a struggle for power. Who's going to be in charge of the world? Our kind of people or theirs?
I beg your pardon, gentlemen. You are, after all, better qualified to judge what is best for the country. I'll do whatever you say.
The professor nodded in reluctant agreement and rose from the table. He ascended the stairs to his bedroom, saying to me,
"Don't forget to wind the restricted clock and put the confidential cat out."
For reasons of national security, Operation Brainstorm was carried on without the knowledge of the American citizenry, which was paying the bill. The observers, technicians, and military men involved in the activity knew that a test was underway. A test of what? They had no idea. Only 37 key men, myself included, knew what was afoot. In Virginia, the day for Operation Brainstorm was unseasonably cool. Inside, a log fire crackled in the fireplace, and the flames were reflected in the polished metal cabinets that lined the living room. All that remained of the room's lovely old furniture was a Victorian love seat set squarely in the center of the floor, facing three television receivers. One long bench had been brought in for the 10 of us privileged to watch. The television screen showed, from left to right, the stretch of desert, which was the rocket target, the guinea pig fleet, and a section of the Aleutian sky through which the radio-controlled bomber formation would roar. 90 minutes before H hour, the radios announced that all was ready on time. Professor Barnhouse was in his bedroom. General Barker bustled about the house like a woman preparing Thanksgiving dinner for 20. At 10 minutes before H hour, the general came in, shepherding the professor before him. The two of them sat side by side on the love seat. The general was rigid and perspiring. The professor was cheerful. He looked at each of the screens, lighted a cigarette, and settled back. Over the radio we heard, "Bomber sighted," and "Rockets away!" All of us looked quickly at the big electric clock over the mantel, while the professor, a half smile on his face, continued to watch the television sets. The general counted away the seconds remaining.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Concentrate.
Professor Barnhouse closed his eyes, pursed his lips, and stroked his temples. He held the position for a minute.
The television images were scrambled and the radio signals were drowned in the din of Barnhouse static. The professor sighed, opened his eyes, and smiled confidently.
Did you give it everything you had?
I was wide open.
The television images pulled themselves together, and mingled cries of amazement came over the radios tuned to the observers. The Aleutian sky was streaked with the smoke trails of bombers screaming down in flames. Simultaneously, there appeared high over the rocket target a cluster of white puffs followed by faint thunder. General Barker shook his head happily.
By George, well, sir, by George, by George, by George!
Look, the fleet, it wasn't touched. But the guns seemed to be drooping.
We left the bench and clustered around the television set to examine the damage more closely. What Mr. Cuthrell had said was true. The guns on the ship curved downward, their muzzles resting on the steel decks. Two short snarls of Barnhouse static shocked us into sudden silence. The radios went dead. We looked around apprehensively. The professor was gone. A harassed guard threw open the front door from the outside to yell that the professor had escaped. He brandished his pistol in the direction of the gates, which hung open, limp and twisted. In the distance, a speeding government station wagon topped a ridge and dropped from sight into the valley beyond. The air was filled with choking smoke, for every vehicle on the ground was ablaze. Pursuit was impossible.
What in God's name got into him?
Mr. Cuthrell, who had rushed out onto the front porch, now slouched back into the room, reading a penciled note as he came.
The good man left this billet doux under the door knocker. Perhaps our young friend here will be kind enough to read it to you, gentlemen, while I take a restful walk through the woods.
He thrust the note into my hands. Gentlemen, as the first superweapon with a conscience, I am removing myself from your national defense stockpile. Setting a new precedent in the behavior of ordnance, I have humane reasons for going off, eh, Barnhouse? Since that day, of course, the professor has been systematically destroying the world's armaments until there is now little with which to equip an army, other than rocks and sharp sticks. His activities haven't exactly resulted in peace, but have rather precipitated a bloodless and entertaining sort of war that might be called the War of the Tattletales. Every nation is flooded with enemy agents whose sole mission is to locate military equipment, which is promptly wrecked when it is brought to the professor's attention in the press. Just as every day brings news of more armaments pulverized by dynamo psychism, so has it brought rumors of the professor's whereabouts. While there are numerous persons eager to kill him, there must be millions who would care for him and hide him. I like to think that he is in the home of such a person. One thing is certain. At this writing, Professor Barnhouse is not dead. Barnhouse static jam broadcast not 10 minutes ago. But those who would make war if they could, in every country in the world, wait in sullen silence for what must come, the passing of Professor Barnhouse. The professor knows that he cannot live much longer. I say this because of the message left in my mailbox on Christmas Eve, unsigned, typewritten on a soiled scrap of paper. The note consisted of 10 sentences, which made no sense to me at first reading. I nearly threw the note away, thinking it a colleague's warped notion of a practical joke. For some reason, though, I added it to the clutter on top of my desk, which included, among other mementos, the professor's dice. It took me several weeks to realize that the message really meant something, that the first 9 sentences, one unsnarled, could be taken as instructions. The 10th sentence, most puzzling and bizarre, still told me nothing. It was only last night that I discovered how it fitted in with the rest. The sentence appeared in my thoughts last night while I was toying absently with the professor's dice. I promise to file this report today in view of what has happened. I am obliged to break that promise, or release the report incomplete. The delay will not be a long one, for one of the few blessings afforded a bachelor like myself, with substantial private means, is the ability to move quickly from one abode to another, from one way of life to another. When this is done, I shall file the report. briefly, I propose to vanish. Sooner or later, Professor Barnhouse must die, but long before then, I shall be ready. So, to the saber-rattlers of today, and even, I hope, of tomorrow, I say, be advised. Barnhouse will die, but not the Barnhouse effect. Last night, I tried once more to follow the oblique instructions on the scrap of paper. I took the professor's dice, and then, with the last nightmarish sentence flitting through my mind, I rolled 50 consecutive sevens. Goodbye.
That was Stephen Thorne, Stephen Berenson, and Kurt Columbus with Kurt Vonnegut's report on the Barnhouse effect here on Trinity Rep Radio Theater. That is classic Kurt Vonnegut.
Beautiful.
And Kurt Vonnegut, who himself went through a horrific experience in World War II and the bombing of Dresden, the only way he can react is with humor and his incredible imagination.
Yeah, and his incredible linguistic ability. I mean, I was struck, we were talking about this in rehearsal, by the fact that he takes an idiom that we know, which is this kind of, you know, H-hour, A-bomb, operation, brainstorm, and throws us all of these beautiful curves about the first super weapon with a conscience. I mean, it's just extraordinary writing.
Where's Professor Barnhouse?
We need him.
Oh, God.
Well, that's why we had to include the story, Bob, is that it just felt like, if you're talking about the spoils of war, we, like Vonnegut, remain hopeful that the Barnhouse effect will appear someday.
And I like the way that the character of Professor Barnhouse, the way he starts off kind of meek, and he wants to do the right thing in giving his information to the government.
Yeah.
But then he finds a spine along the way that he decides that they're not telling him how best to use his powers, and he's going to take it upon himself, and he stands up against them, and he's off, and he's doing his own thing.
Yep. And the most ludicrous character becomes the most reasonable. I think, Stephen Thorne, you pointed this out in rehearsal the other day.
Just the absurdity in most of Vonnegut's writing has this kind of comic absurdity of like things that seem so insane but are actually completely rooted in reality. I mean, I love it when he says, doesn't it seem reasonable that nobody would fight wars if there were enough of everything to go around? This is mm-hmm. Professor Barnhouse saying this. And you know, everyone around him is like, that's nuts. That's crazy. What are you talking about? Like, well, wait a second. Everything's gotten reversed. What happened?
Yeah, the most rational and reasonable people end up being the craziest. Hey, we also, Bob, have to give you a little shout-out because you played General Ernest Barter.
It's a great privilege. Thank you very much.
Well done. Loved
having you in our cast.
Well, you've been listening to Trinity Rep Radio Theater, and you can hear this program again and find archived programs at WRNI.org. This program featured Lafayette Farewell by Ray Bradbury, broadcast with the permission of Don Cognan Associates, Incorporated, copyright 1988 by Ray Bradbury. My War by Diane C. Jaeger, copyright by the author 1991, from the anthology Visions of War, Dreams of Peace, published by Warner Books 1991. And Report on the Barnhouse Effect by Kurt Vonnegut from Welcome to the Monkey House, copyright 1950. Trinity Rep Radio Theater is a production of WRNI and Trinity Repertory Company. Janice Duclos and Emily Atkinson, producers. Kurt Columbus, executive producer. Joe O'Connor, general manager. And Jim Moses, sound engineer. Trinity Rep Radio Theater is made possible in part by generous support from the Carter Family Charitable Trust. Thank you for joining us, and please tune in again next month. I'm Bob C.